In this video, we are going to be talking about the Italian film from 1990, Everybody's Fine, Italian translation is Stanno Tutti Bene, which starred Marcello Mastroianni, and it was directed by Giuseppe Tornatore. My guest today is filmmaker Sean Garrity, who is known for Lucid, Inertia, and An Awkward Sexual Adventure, and most recently, I Propose We Never See Each Other Again After Tonight. Sean, thanks again for returning to my podcast.
Nice. See, I liked it so much, I had to come back.
No, I appreciate that, and I really enjoyed our Ozu discussion last time. So this is an Italian film discussion, so I was curious, because this is something I do often on my podcast, is a lot of Italian movies. So I was curious what you were interested in. And I had heard about this movie mainly because I knew the remake, the De Niro with De Niro, Everybody's Fine. Yeah. I knew it was an Italian remake. I didn't realize it was with Mastroianni or that Tornatore directed it. So why is this a film that interested you to discuss? Aside from the fact that I asked you to pick something Italian.
Well, you know, I mean, when I was thinking about that and you sort of said, you know, pick something Italian, I remember that, you know, after seeing, you know, Cinema Paradiso, I remember being very taken by the direction, by the style of that film and by his lyricism. And so I kind of sought out other films of his, and I was a very young guy, I was in university, and, you know, after this film, he made a series of other films that I thought were brilliant, were really, really great. The direction was just stunning. That never really moved the needle commercially. Like after Cinema Paradiso, it was like the world at large kind of forgot about him, you know, and he continued. I mean, this film, as you saw, you know, won the big award at Cannes and played at Venice. And, you know, there was still that kind of festival art house.
Yeah,
recognition, but he never really broke through commercially internationally again the way he did with Cinema Paradiso. So a lot of these films, I mean, today we're talking about Stanno Tutti Bene, but I mean, it's, you know, the Star Maker and Malena and a lot of his other movies, just kind of, you have to sort of really go find them. They're out there, but they're not, you know, they're not easily accessible.
Yeah, no, I had to thoroughly look for this one. Because yeah, you're right. It's not easy to find. Is there anything that indicates as to why after Cinema Paradiso his films just didn't take off? Is it just kind of what happened?
I mean, I don't know why. I think, you know, I mean, it gets into a whole discussion about the kind of the gatekeepers of our industry in a way, right? Because I think Cinema Paradiso, in fact, one of the things that I wasn't crazy about with Cinema Paradiso, which was that very saccharine ending that it has, I think was the reason that international distributors picked it up.
Right, it's They're very like, oh, sentimental.
It's sentimental, yeah. It's feel good. There's that big rush of music at the end with all the cuts of the kisses and the, you know. And his other films were definitely not that, right? Like Malena ends in tragedy. This film in a way ends in a very kind of layered, bittersweet tragedy that I love. You know, Star Maker ends in tragedy. And I think that's a big reason. You know, we were talking about my 2005 film Lucid earlier, and you know, that was a film where I was at a film festival in Shanghai and met with a Chinese distributor who was interested in the film, and her first question is, before she'd watched it, she was like, I'm very interested in this film because it played Toronto, I got these awards, blah blah blah, I'd like to buy it, does it have a happy ending? Her question number one. Right, I'm seeing it at a film festival, does it have a happy ending? Because it jumps over the fence from festival film to commercial film, it seems, if it has a happy ending.
I see.
And so in my sense, I mean, this film is, you know, Stanno Tutti Bene is a beautiful, it's a gorgeous film and very layered, very similar in a way to Tokyo Story that we were talking about last time. Ozu's Tokyo Story.
I really saw that as well. Yeah. It really pops out.
Totally. And there's something very true about it. That is, you know, the inevitability of this kind of entropy, that everything moves towards, you know, falling apart and everything moves towards, you know, decay and destruction, that's the direction of everything in life, including us, including our relationships, including our societies. But yeah, it's not a feel-good message, right? It's not something that makes you, right? And I love that in this film, he doesn't try to take a position on it. Like, oh yeah, that's the way things go in our relationships and in our societies. But look, there's flowers. Like, it's not that at all. It's like, at the end of the film, it's like, that's the way it is. So, you know, we tell little lies to ourselves and to the people that we love to shield them as best we can. But, you know, in the end, you know, there's this sense of maturity, I thought, with that theme, that when I saw it as a young man, I was like, wow, there's something very powerful about how he doesn't shy away from that, you know, inevitable truth. It's not like it's a shock to anybody. If you really think about it, it's obvious. But I mean, that he presents it in this film in a way that is entertaining and manages to not be dark.
Yeah.
You know, like the Robert De Niro one, which you mentioned earlier, is dark.
Much darker. Dark film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the genius of Tornatore as a director, I think, is this idea of a director as a conductor of various elements. Like, he understood that you get, you know, Marcello Mastroianni playing the lead role, and he brings this kind of lightness to it and this kind of positive energy to it that manages to play in counterpoint to these really kind of very dark themes. And then he's got this, you know, Ennio Morricone score that it's also very light and whimsical. And his observations that he makes all the way through about, you know, how a television is really just as good as a washing machine in terms of color and movement. And
I love that. Right?
Yeah. And all the way through, the observations that he makes about the decay of society are very kind of funny, clever, but whimsical. And the way he juxtaposes that tone with the subject matter, I think, makes it a much more watchable movie. It's interesting that you know, Robert De Niro, he's no schlumpy. He's an amazing actor.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, there's a gear of positivity that Mastroianni has that De Niro just does not have.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And he just pulls that thing down right into the depths.
No, I absolutely agree. And that is so spot on, and it is exactly what I thought, because as much as I'm a huge De Niro fan, but
yeah, me too.
When he doesn't have that lightness, as you said, and even though he's done a lot of comedies, it's a specific type of comedy where he's like, you know, doing a take on the gangsters he's played, like Analyze This, like those kind of things. But you're right. He was very solemn in that movie, whereas Mastroianni, he just brought such a lightness and spirit, and he's like the grandfather you've always wanted or that you've had, you know. And I thought those Coke bottle glasses he had, he's even a little heavier in it. I don't know if he just happened to be heavier in the film or if he maybe intentionally gained weight for the film, but just that, you know, it's very Italian. I mean, I've all my grandfathers and uncles I've had, just that innocence that he brought to it. He's from Sicily, he's from a small town in Sicily. He's going into Rome where everything is evolved and is changing and is so different. I really loved it. I mean, I really liked the De Niro one too. I was surprised that it didn't, it kind of came and went. But I really preferred this one because it's such a beautiful story and message about, you know, I think really about parenting, in the sense that, you know, so many people tell their kids, you know, you got to you got to be great and do something important, and they think they're doing the right thing. But then if that doesn't work out for these people, you know, you see his kids are separated, or their career didn't pan out the way they wanted it to, and they're lying to him and covering things up. And I think a lot of people can relate to doing that with their parents, you know? So I just thought it was heartbreaking that he doesn't know really anything about them. And then in the end, he really learns that lesson as to, you know, he tells that other kid who's the grandson who's got his girlfriend pregnant. I love that. You know, don't teach them to be important. Teach them to be ordinary. Just teach them to basically be happy. But you're right, because it's not so much of a happy ending. It's like, it's bittersweet, because he goes to the grave, his wife's grave, and you know, he says
the title of the film, right?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, don't worry, everybody's fine.
did you take that as, is he lying to her, or is he saying no, this is a good thing? They're fine because they're living life. They've got jobs. Yes, they have problems, but they're fine. I mean, what did you think?
Well, I mean, I love that he is kind of one of the last in a generation of European filmmakers who really love to embrace that kind of ambiguity in their endings, right?
Yes.
That, like, an ambiguity that asks you to then revisit the material and say, what is the filmmaker kind of saying here? Because as you said, it could be a sense of, he realizes that we lie to each other out of love. That we carry these lies. You know, I remember talking to a friend of mine about an affair he was having years ago. And you know, we were having this discussion, and I was very much of the position that he should tell his wife. And he was like, "That's cruel, because if I tell my wife, then I feel like, huh, it's off my chest. But then she has to carry it around.
Right.
And how is that fair? Like, I should carry this dark secret, and it should eat me up from the inside, and that is my punishment for what I've done, right? And this idea that when we carry those lies with us, we bear the weight of that, and we spare the people that we love, which is a really kind of controversial, almost subversive idea. But, you know,
is
that what he's after? Could be, right? The ending certainly allows that interpretation. But the interpretation that you kind of talk about, right? And I think one of the things that I love about this film is how it explores the paradox of this idea that if you have a healthy relationship with your kid, with your kids, I have one kid, so I say kid, but I mean, if you have a healthy relationship with your kids, the proper relationship, a good relationship, ends in separation, right? If you do a great job of bringing your kids up, then by the time they're 18 to 20, they're like, they can't wait to get out. They can't wait to be independent and move away from you, right? Which is a weird paradox, but that's the way that works.
Yeah.
You know, and he really, I think, digs into that here. And
absolutely.
And, right, drills down on what does that mean, and how is that sad, but also beautiful, right?
Yes. Yeah. And you're right in terms of looking at, like, Tokyo Story, because it's very similar in that sense. And it's true, because you, I mean, in my opinion, and I also have, you know, one child, and you want your kids to grow up and be able to land on their, you know, their own two feet, and for them to be happy. But it's unfortunate that a lot of people don't look at it that way. It's sort of, if my kids are leaving at 19, they must hate me. And it's really not the case. And I thought this is a great lesson for parents to see this film. But not only that, just it's universal in the sense that, you know, having open dialogues with our parents, and maybe even talking about problems that you have with your parents, is a good thing. And I like at the end of the film where they even, when they're forced to say, you know, well, I know you feel strongly about marriage, so how can I tell you that I got divorced? And well, and it's a shame, because those people had to bury all of those feelings inside themselves and not be able to share it with, you know, their father and their mother. And it's so simple, but yet it's so true. And you're right, it's complicated in the sense that you want your children to be independent and land on their feet, but at the same time, we don't always send them off in the right way. So that's the great thing about that ending.
Well, totally. And, you know, and this larger idea that the imperfect life is the only life that we have. Every one of us lead these very imperfect lives where we're very flawed. And that's kind of, in a sense, what makes us human. Certainly as a screenwriter, when I'm writing stuff, the flaws are that's the fun stuff, right? That's the interesting stuff.
Absolutely.
In characters. And yet it stands in opposition to the story, that the narrative that we like to tell about our lives. And I mean, today, you know, I think had this been made today, this film, in the area of social media, I think there's a whole extra layer that he could have added on that would have been very interesting. But in a sense, there is that kind of theme here where each kid is kind of designing the narrative of their lives for consumption by their father. This is the story of my life that you want to hear, right? You don't want to hear the imperfect, flawed version. That's the real version. That's the way I see it. You know, and that costs, and I do it for you because I love you. That's why I do it.
Yeah.
Right. and that I lie to you because I love you, and that he doesn't come down as like, that's wrong, kids. Like, it's not an after school special at the end. He's like, kids, that's not the way to do it.
Right.
Not at all. Right. There's a recognition, I think, by possibly by an interpretation of the ending when he goes back and says exactly that to his wife. Because why worry her? She's dead. Why should he worry her? Right. Everyone's fine.
Yeah.
And don't worry about a thing. It's funny because I actually saw also the Chinese one. Did we talk about this? That there's a Chinese one?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'll have to see that.
There's a Chinese version of this, also called Everybody's Fine. You know, because you and I have talked about this a lot, I'm a huge fan of Chinese cinema.
Yes.
And so I was like, and when I think about it, and I think about our stereotypes about these cultures, about Italian culture, about American culture, and you look at the story, you kind of go like, wow, China makes way more sense for this story than America does for a remake. Mm-hmm. Right? Because I mean, this idea of very tight families, countries that have histories of extended families, you know, countries that have histories of parents kind of kids not being open with their parents because they want them to, you know, accept them, and they hide their more controversial choice. Like that story, when I thought about it, that was like, of course, China. That works way better in China.
That's a good point. Yeah. And myself being Italian, I could really relate to a lot that I saw here. But you're right, in America being much more of a looser and not having that sense of, I mean, you know, America's multicultural, right? So it makes more sense to have a culture that is so ingrained with perhaps this way of living and thinking amongst family. I imagine that's what you were getting at.
Both. Yeah. I think it's both the question of family and the micro cultural stuff about how we, you know, I think in a lot of East Asian cultures, but China specifically, you know, if you were gay, as one of the characters is here, that you wouldn't tell your parent that in China, and that would kind of be normal. Whereas in the States, I think, and in Canada as well, there'd be a sense of like, oh, come on, you got to come out to your parents, like,
right? Yeah,
of course,
yeah,
right. But that's not the case in China, and maybe that's not the case in Italy. Certainly, maybe not the case in Italy in the 1990s when this movie was made. And I think that's the other thing that I think is really clever about this film, that the American one didn't quite manage to get right, I think, is that this film, it's also about contemporary Italy, right? Mm, contemporary to the 1990s, right? I mean, the fact that our character basically tours Naples, Rome, Florence, Milan, and Turin, and I actually looked it up, he actually filmed at 75 urban and rural Italian locations. It's travelogue of Italy.
Yeah.
Right? And he kind of takes this not tremendously new idea that technology dehumanizes and distances us from one another, and but really visualizes it in a way of, I don't know if you noticed all of those, this kind of repeated shot of descending into a circle when we're into the cities. Like there's a couple of shots of these giant circles and the camera like kind of flies into them, like we're descending into the concentric circles of hell.
Yeah.
You know, and he visually paints cities as, he uses a long lens, everything is compressed, everything is jumbled in, and there's lots of smoke always everywhere. And it's very, there's a lot of hellscape-like imagery in
the big crowds.
Crowds and stopped traffic and birds that lose their way and die.
Yeah, that was, with the pigeons. Yeah, yep. That scene. He had those different sort of metaphors every now and then. Like there was another one with the deer at one point. And I thought maybe that was like, you know, because the deer is displaced in that moment, not in its own, you know, orbits. And I thought that what he was saying something about the character. I don't know what you thought about that scene.
Certainly he brings Mastroianni into these cities as like a Mr. Magoo, right? He's got these giant Coke bottle glasses, big cartoon eyes that doesn't allow him to see. I mean, I think the metaphor is very deliberate on Tornatore's part. It doesn't allow him to see what he doesn't want to see,
right?
And this idea of being kind of in many of the scenes, you watch the way that Mastroianni plays it, he's kind of a deer in the headlights. He's kind of stumbling through this urban landscape without really kind of understanding it or having the capacity to understand it, given the way that he sees the world.
Exactly.
And so for me, I thought that was a moment where he almost seemed to turn it and sort of say, you know, I mean, the city doesn't see him either. He doesn't really see the city for what it is. He sees it as a hellscape. Mm-hmm. But the city also doesn't really see him.
Right.
And I thought that that was this moment where the city was kind of forced to see somebody like him, and that, you know, they just, what do? They stop. They don't know how to.
That's right.
Everything comes to a stop when there's this deer who doesn't know where it is and doesn't understand its surroundings, and they don't quite know how to handle the deer either. Like, what do you? You shouldn't be here in the middle of an expressway. What are you doing here?
Just like no one knows how to deal with him.
Yeah, you know, there's I think a sense. I'm not sure that he meant it to be as literal a metaphor as that, but I think there are a lot of ideas there that resonate, you know, with a lot of the thematic material of the show. That it reminds. Did you ever see The River? It was a Mel Gibson movie from the 80s.
I don't think so. I know.
Very, very old movie. Yeah, it was a great movie, I thought. But it has almost exactly the same scene in it. All these guys working in a factory, and a deer wanders into the factory, and everything just kind of stops, and everyone just kind of wanders away from this inhuman technology that they're tied to all day. Right. Be fascinated by this deer, this connection to the kind of the real, if you will, world. Right. Which is in many senses the world that you know, Matteo Scuro, that Mastroianni's character comes from.
Yes.
Right? On the seaside, and he lives in this old apartment. We meet him while he's got a bunch of wine on the table, and the ocean breeze outside the window, and right?
Yeah.
There's an idea of that kind of world that he comes from that perhaps Tornatore is saying that it's the world that is being lost in our rush to modernize. But I bring that up in the context of the Chinese film, because I mean, oh my God, nowhere is that more true
than
China, right? Like, wow, China 20 years ago was a completely different country.
Yes.
You know, I was there in 1996 and people were still wearing like the Mao suits. And I remember with my travel companion, we were backpacking. I was like, so the green ones are for urban workers and the blue ones are for rural workers. Is that, because we saw both. But man, you don't see those anymore. You don't see any of that world anymore in China. Like, it's a completely new society. And so in a sense that the Chinese one on that particular thematic issue kind of worked better.
I imagine it would. What year was the Chinese one?
It's roughly really recent.
Oh, it's a recent. Okay, I'll have to find that.
It's quite recent. It's also called Everybody's Fine. And I gotta say, of the three, certainly none of them work as well as Tornatore. Tornatore is a genius director who just really is able to corral all of these elements to get just the tone that he wants, that is at the same time funny and whimsical and tragic and profound and, you know, clever and observation. It just is bang on. The Americans kind of fail. I think the Chinese one doesn't quite get it, but I will say this, the Chinese one has like jaw droppingly gorgeous cinematography beginning to end. I was like dazzled. I was watching part of it with my daughter actually. And there was one shot that came up where we were both just like, oh, like we gasped. So, so beautiful.
I'll have to see that one. And I agree. You know, the more I think about the remake, as much as I always enjoyed it. It is very one note, as you were saying, and just the darkness, the depression of it all. And then they just kind of spun this happy ending in the way. But, you know, Tornatore, he just seamlessly had this beautiful lightness and use of metaphors and drama and these great characters. I particularly love those scenes on the train when he has, every time he goes for the ticket and the photo of his family would fall out, and he's showing everyone so much pride. And then, you know, again, where the guy accidentally stapled it, and now he put, you know, right. It's so obvious what that meant, that there's holes here, you know, and after that, when he finds out everything, and that one woman asks if he was in show business, because they're all in costume. And, you know, he doesn't even want to talk about them anymore. He just says, oh yeah. Show business. I just thought that spoke volumes by just this picture, just looking at this picture in these different train rides and
how he recontextualizes it given where it pops out in the story, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I really love that. And I thought it was so emotional every time he would see his children and then see them as kids as they're approaching him. Just that sense of, you know, he can't protect him like he could. And I think that dream as well, like those alien abductions of his children being abducted. It was so strange, but it's kind of funny that they're hanging onto these strings of and going up, and you know, he knows something's wrong. I mean, but he doesn't know what, and he's being haunted by that. I just thought that was so brilliant and yet so emotional at the same time, because I think every parent can relate to when their kids are off, that it's out of their hands, you know, and at the same time, you want them to go off, but you want to protect them, but you can't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the other things in comparing the versions that is interesting is that Tornatore is not afraid to show his character as, like, I mean, Robert De Niro in the American version is this poor father being ignored by his kids.
Yeah.
You know, and we see his, how, you know, brokenhearted he is by all of it. And when we really get into it, there's a mention of, well, when we were kids, you used to be a lot stricter and you used to push us a lot harder. And so therefore, but Tornatore doesn't like shy away from that. There's that scene near the end where they're having the big dinner for everyone and only his two sons show up.
Right.
And they tell him that Alvaro has died. And he just, you see how his delusion is self-serving in a way. There's a layer there for the first time when you see it, not as a flashback, not as a mention of like, oh, well, you used to do this to us. Like, no. Like, even now he's like, oh, that's not true. Why would you tell me that?
Right.
This expectation that they would continue to sort of place his emotional stability, or if you will, his happiness above the truth. Like, how dare they tell him that?
Yeah.
Right. And he does it in real time. It's like, this is a flawed character right now, not in the backstory. Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and so, you know, there is some sense of the responsibility that he has in crafting and how complicit he is. He's not a victim of this story. He's complicit in it. Right. And
absolutely.
I think that gives kind of a roundness to it that the American version and also the Chinese version aren't quite brave enough to do.
Yeah, no, well said. And yeah, in that moment, because, you know, you see him and he's like this harmless grandfather you feel, but when he says, well, you hit us when we were young, and he's like, it was just to make you strong. But suddenly when he lashes out at them, he's scary in that moment. I can see him, the younger version of this man. And, you know, Mastroianni has the depth to go there as well. Yeah. And it's so intense and still, and just really captured the essence of that man as everything that he had a hunch about these lies and stuff is really coming out. But you're right. That's a good point, because he's not just a victim, because he has to take responsibility of the fact that his kids felt that way, that they couldn't tell him stuff because of the way he was being. And they tell him too, right? Well, you know, you think, you look at this way of marriage and you wanted this from us. And he continues to feed them with the, you know, well, I was just trying to do this. And he had good intentions, of course, but he just wasn't equipped to handle it better. And I love in the hospital scene, you know, I couldn't help but laugh because that's so true, you know. And I've heard, even an extended family of mine, you know, you'd see them at weddings and funerals and hospitals, and that was it. And I love that when he's in the hospital and everyone's finally there, and that's the first thing he says, it takes me going to the hospital to get everyone together.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that truth and that sense of how true so much of it is really the magic of this film. He manages to be lyrical, and he manages to have this kind of, you know, hero's journey, and yet everything about it is so true. Every little observation he makes along the way about family and about society, you sort of, even if you don't necessarily agree with it, it really like lands, you know what I mean? All of it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's really, like I said, strongly relatable. The sequence with his daughter who was an actress and a fashion model, I love that one. I really like that one the best, because he did so much of it, I felt, visually, in terms of, you know, you see this baby, you know, because I thought, well, that's strange. There's a baby there, and she's saying that, oh, well, the mother is going to come pick this baby up. You know, first of all, you know, you don't need a baby to even know, like, how could you leave a baby alone with this older man who doesn't know this child? And, you know, no one would do that. So I thought, okay, that must be a lie. You don't know for sure, because then this woman comes, picks this baby up. But then when you see that same woman with that baby at the fashion show, because then she's at that fashion show, I, you know, no one says anything. There's no dialogue like, oh, you know, your father's on to me or something. You just see her there. And I was like, pretty sure it's a lie. And then, you know, the next shot later, a little later on, is his daughter nursing this child. So
yeah,
there you go. That's her child. And all that is done with no dialogue. I thought that was really, really well done. And even when he's hugging her, you know, she's straightening herself out. She's hiding the fact that she's done, you know, lingerie ads, that she's putting them away. And I doubt this was accidental. They must have done it intentionally when she straightens the picture and then it and then it goes crooked again, right? It's like,
yeah,
you know, I thought that said so much about you know, you can't, you know, when you try to hide, eventually things crack, you know, things are going to go crooked again. How did you feel about that sequence? I thought, to me, that was one of the most interesting ones.
Yeah. Well, and it points to one of the things that I also really love about the film was, performance wise, the actors playing the role within the role, and this sense that we all know, but that, you know, you don't see as often in cinema, where you play a role as part of a family. You play a role, yeah, for your father.
Absolutely.
But the actors literally would play it. Like that scene where she's nursing, she's very different as a character than she is when she's with her dad. And I'm sure you remember, there's a whole bunch of scenes where they would take the dad to a train station or a bus station or whatever. I think they're all train stations in the Italian one.
Yeah.
And as soon as the dad turns away and starts walking towards the train, the actors playing the kids change, right?
Yes,
they take,
yes,
off the disguise.
The mask. Yeah.
Yeah. And their faces suddenly become more serious and more adult. And it feels like they're ready to be in a different movie almost.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really, again,
I love
completely
that.
Visually told. There's no reference to it, but
yeah.
A lovely, again, sinks it in as a really honest observation.
That's a really good point. And I mean, you probably know better as a screenwriter, but that is you're right. You don't see that very much in cinema. You see often people being very honest, and because maybe that's easier to tell because you're trying to get to the truth. But I imagine it's much harder to write those masks that we wear in life, because it's so, I mean, Tornatore he just really understood that. I mean, I thought that was just, but you're right. And it's not with dialogue. It is with these amazing sequences some of them, of course, are with dialogue, you know, somewhat. You see the one of his sons, the drummer with his wife, you know, obviously that's an ex-wife, and they're separated and talking about, well, you know, we can't tell them and such in the car. But that's true. It's so much of these acts, and we're one way with our son, one way with our mother, one way with our father. That is so true. And I wish I saw that more in movies. I don't know. Is that hard to write, do you think? Is that harder?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it's hard to write, but certainly for the actor, it creates just a second layer. I mean, you know,
yeah,
this is an actor. Like
you have to be aware of it.
You have to be aware that I'm playing this whole sequence or this whole section of the script, not as me, as me pretending to be someone pretending to be someone.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's another layer that I'm going to drop down to when he turns his back and goes. It really gives it some depth that I think adds to the picture. And his lyricism overall is something that is completely missing from the other two versions of this. Right. With stuff like the birds and stuff that, you know, like everyone stopping when he has the answering machine from Aldo.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
even the idea of, like, you know, the kids feel that they have to have a life. They have to perform for him a life that is somehow significant.
Right.
And then the reality of what happened to Alvaro is like this lyrical exaggeration of the very opposite of significance, that he just rose out to sea and disappears,
yeah,
is swallowed by the nothingness.
Yes.
Right. It's so, so great.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, and in the other versions of it, they totally have lost that. I think you remember in the American version, he goes to Mexico and he's in jail and he's addicted to something and he overdoses and dies, right?
Something, yeah. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember De Niro found out about it when he's in the hospital, and it's extremely dramatic. I mean, it's beautifully acted, but it's very,
right,
as you said, it's very sad, very dark. I remember I was seeing this woman, at the time when that came out, and we were at the theaters, and she was crying so hard that she called her father afterwards to say that she loved him. And I think it worked on that level, but you're right, it doesn't have all that range and that lyricism that you pointed out. It really only focused on one side of this story, you know. And even the posters for it afterwards, they're making it look like it was a Christmas movie or something. Yeah, like, I thought ads were ridiculous for that.
Yes,
because it came out, I think, towards the end of the year.
And that's how it's scored too, right? I mean, it's interesting, you know, people don't pay a lot of attention to score,
right?
But certainly, I mean, Tornatore uses the score here as instrumental. All of the music is very whimsical. It's all in a major key. It's all like Mr. Magoo Goes on an Adventure kind of music.
Yes.
There's never a repetition in the score of what we're seeing on the screen emotionally, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. Right?
What we're seeing on the screen is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And the music is whimsical, which ironically makes it more heartbreaking. Right. Whereas in the De Niro version, you see this sad moment and where his kids don't show up at his house and they all abandon him. And then the music is also sad.
Yeah. And it's too much.
Exactly. You feel like you're being kind of manipulated. That's the Hallmark part of it. You know, I think that movie, I think it actually predates actual Hallmark movies, but it certainly feels like, I wonder if they got a hold of it at Hallmark and they're like, this is our model. We got to make
these. Let's keep doing these. Yeah. Yes. No, that's true. It's like, I think Paul Schrader had this great way of looking at more conventional Hollywood filmmaking, as calling it like empathetic filmmaking. Like, we're going to grab you by the throat and tell you exactly what's going on here. And to me, that's so, you're right. It's manipulative. I'm not involved here. You're leaving me out, and you're showing me, you're showing me one side of the story. So
I mean, I think, it's all manipulative. I mean, as filmmakers, we manipulate sound and image and emotion to try and get a real, but I think there's an underestimation of the audience in the De Niro, that path, right? They're really going to force you to feel this. Yeah. Whereas I think with the Tornatore version, you're left with these bizarrely disparate pieces and you put it together yourself, and then it's the emotional reaction is so much more rewarding.
Exactly. And as we've been discussing with that ending, he's leaving it to us. Like, what does that mean? Is it another lie, or does he really mean they're fine, they're ordinary, I should have known better in my raising of them, or something along those lines, which I find really, really fascinating. This really needs to be put out. I mean, I hope Criterion Collection or Kino Lorber, someone, if you're watching, put this, remaster this. I wonder if this had been made 20, 30 years before, if we would be looking at it in the way that people look at 8.5 nowadays, which, I love. But maybe at that time when, the industry in Italy particularly had changed drastically so much, it's just the timing. It's made at a time when people just weren't as interested in Italian films, but it's certainly, a wonderful piece. So if people can find it, I highly recommend it. And I'm really glad, Sean, that you brought it to my attention, because I was really floored by it, really moved by it. So,
yeah. Well, and if I can make a pitch for, we were talking about this, I think, when we were talking about what we wanted to talk about in this podcast. I mean, he did another film. He's done a bunch of films, but he did another film right, I don't know if it was right after this or two films after this, called The Star Maker, which is also one of my favorite films.
Yeah, I was looking at that yesterday. That looks really good too.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, like when I was asked, when we were talking, and I was like, which is my favorite Tornatore film? I was kind of torn. I was like, is it this one or is it Star Maker? Because they're both so good and so rich and thematically so brave.
Yeah.
And he also brings that same lyricism, but that same sense of kind of the European version of a blockbuster. Like, I mean, American blockbusters are explosions and chase scenes and right. But I mean, the European blockbusters, especially in this era, were like, like that scene in that train station where they all freeze.
Yes.
When the message comes up, like that's not a CGI effect.
No.
He brought in 3,000 extras into that giant train station.
I wondered about that, because I was like, that doesn't look fake.
If you look really carefully, because I actually did pause it and look back at it, you can see some of them kind of slightly moving. way
in the background.
Yeah. And so that's just like a guy with a bazillion dollars who's like, I'm not going to use it for an explosion or a CGI effect. I'm going to like orchestrate a giant, you know, cinematic thing. A lot of those big scenes out in the cities with the extras and the cars and all, he's just got these resources and he's really using them. And the Star Maker is more of that.
I'm certainly going to seek out more of his work. I know that A Pure Formality, I've seen that on Canopy. So I don't know if you've seen that one.
I have not seen it, but if it's on Canopy, I'll see it this
week. Yeah, I'll have to check out that one. But you're right, because I always liked Cinema Paradiso, but I was never like, who is this director? Because it was, you know, like as we were saying, it was a little too sentimental for my taste, even though I liked the story. But when I saw Everybody's Fine, my reaction was, I mean, I knew who the director was now, but I got to go see more of his films. You know, I think it left me, which the best kind of, you know, movies do in my, in my opinion. But I'm certainly going to check out more of his work.
Yeah. I remember when Milena came out as well, which is another one.
That's 2000, right? Year 2000. Yeah. That's one that I've been meaning to see as well.
Yeah.
So
great. Another great one, right? It's really with what's her name? Monica Bellucci.
I think
and she's obviously amazing.
Yeah.
And he repeats in that one his incredible ability that you see in this film, more so in Cinema Paradiso, to get incredible performances out of kids.
Mm.
Right? Which is one of his superpowers.
Yes. He's like De Sica in that sense. I mean, it's amazing what they, you know, you look at the children in De Sica's films and you're thinking, how did they get these kids to do this?
Yeah, totally. And he has that same ability, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The children in this were all in those fantasies were all just, I mean, it really got to me emotionally. I mean, it was just really floored me how powerful.
And then masterfully he turns it, right? Like in the end where all four kids come back in that final sequence.
That's right.
Actually no longer cute and heartbreaking. It's kind of haunting almost. There's something almost eerie about it.
Yes.
And he just masterfully manipulates tone through a combination of the performance and the way he shoots it and the music and everything else to sort of ask you to see it from a slightly different angle. Yes. As he does with a lot of this and a lot of the characters and a lot of the themes all the way through the movie.
Wow. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I'm excited to see more of his work, because I think this film is just absolutely exceptional. Can you talk about anything you're working on now, Sean?
You know, it's the usual. Like, I mean, I Propose We Never See Each Other Again After Tonight is we're in the process of getting it into the States. We have the number one, they're more than a broadcaster. What are they like? They're like nothing in Canada is kind of like them. They're kind of like Fox in the States, I guess, without the crazy right wing part of it. But in the sense that they do movies, they do TV, they do TV fiction, they do TV news. They also do web. They do everything. It's this giant company, the biggest company in the country, called ABS-CBN in the Philippines, that is very excited to pick up the film.
Oh, that's great.
And we're just negotiating. They also have this really great series of streaming services that gets to the Filipino diaspora. So there's a lot of Filipinos obviously here and in the States, but in Saudi and in Britain and, you know, Japan and everywhere. And so they service all of those communities. So
amazing.
Yeah, we're just working out, and we have an American company that wants to pick it up. And partly what I'm in the middle of now is each one of them wants some rights in the States, and so I'm trying to get them to, you know, without me paying for everybody's lawyers, get them to sort of work that out. And I am shooting something that I'm very excited about in November. It's a script that my frequent collaborator Jonas Chernik and myself worked on years ago, and we kind of put it away. And recently an opportunity came up to sort of make something quick and dirty, and this company with a whole bunch of money was like, if you've got a script that's ready to go. And we kind of sorted through our old dust bins on our computers of like, how about this one? We worked on this one 10 years ago, and this one three. Yeah. And this one, when we both read it again, it was suddenly fresh for us again, having not seen it in 5 years. And we were like, wow, this is really funny. How come we never made this?
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yes.
So now we, you know, we've updated. It's amazing how cell phone technology and the other technologies that we're so addicted to change the very fabric of our lives. You know, because we had to go through the script and say like, oh, wow, this no longer makes sense. And this no longer makes sense. And he or she would just like text him. I don't know why.
Right.
We got to rewrite this. But once we kind of updated it, yeah, we're now looking at casting, and we're hopefully shooting in November.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, that's, you know, best of luck with all the projects, and thanks again for bringing this to my attention, because like I said, I really absolutely love it. And for those of you watching now, you can also check out my podcast, which is, there is now an audio version on Spotify and Amazon and wherever you listen to your podcasts. And I have on my Patreon membership, I have an entire tier, which is dedicated to Italian film. And the link is in the description box below if you're interested in becoming a member. And if this is your first time on my podcast on YouTube, please consider subscribing by clicking on the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it floating above my head right here to your top left. Just click on that and then click the little bell beside it in order to get a notification every time I release one of my new episodes. Sean, thanks again. Really appreciate you coming on. Hope to have you again soon.
Thanks.
And we'll see everyone soon.